Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with increasing tensions between the White House and the press over the government snooping on the AP and a Fox News reporter, which has prompted the New York Times to editorialize that the Obama administration has moved beyond protecting government secrets to threatening fundamental freedoms of the press to gather news. A former Justice Department legal ethics advisor who now represents whistleblowers, Jesselyn Raddick, joins us. She is the National Security and Human Rights Director at the Government Accountability Project. Then we will speak with Arnold Hamilton, the editor of the Oklahoma Observer, about the hypocrisy of Oklahoma's Senators Imhoff and Coburn, who have consistently opposed federal disaster aid that the state now sorely needs. Following the disastrous destruction of lives and property from tornadoes that killed young children in their unprotected schools, we will discuss the Republican-dominated state government's war on education, where the school budgets have been cut by 30% in the past few years, with the governor proposing teachers arm themselves at their own expense while she cuts their pay. Then finally, Richard Wolff, Emeritus Professor of Economics at the University of Massachusetts and author of Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism, joins us to offer his critique of U.S. and global capitalism. With the rich getting richer and the poor poorer, we will discuss what can be done to revive a democracy captured by plutocrats and corporatists to restore a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. Joining us now is Jesselyn Raddick, the Government Accountability Project's National Security and Human Rights Director, where she works with National Security and Intelligence Community whistleblowers, including those from the Defense Department, Homeland Security, NSA, and CIA. She recently represented former NSA official Thomas Drake in the government's unsuccessful prosecution of him under the Espionage Act and is now representing former CIA officer John Kiriakou. She served in the Department of Justice as a legal ethics advisor for 3 years, which led to her becoming a whistleblower in the case of the American Taliban, John Walker Lind, the first high-profile terrorism prosecution following 9/11. The author of Traitor, The Whistleblower and the American Taliban, she has an article at the Daily Kos, Obama's hollow promise that DOJ won't prosecute press. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jesselyn Raddick.
Thank you for having me.
And I guess the White House Press Secretary, Jay Carney, he's having a difficult time, is he not, explaining to the press, who are clearly not happy, that the White House really does defend freedom of the press?
Yeah, that's kind of a tough sell for a number of reasons, not the least of which that is that for the last 3 years, he's been waging an unprecedented crackdown on whistleblowers, charging people under the Espionage Act for allegedly mishandling allegedly classified information. And it's been quite a brutal campaign. Probably the most visible defendant in that is Bradley Manning. Though certainly, Tom Drake's case collapsed in pretty spectacular fashion. And unfortunately, John Kiriakou, who never tortured anyone, ended up being the one to go to jail, even though he blew the whistle on the torture program. So now, I mean, for years, I feel like I've been shouting into the wilderness that journalists really need to worry about this, not only because if whistleblowers are silenced, their sources dry up, but also because of their own interest insofar as I think this is a backdoor way of going after the government, going after journalists. And I think we saw that in full fruition this week.
Well, of course, the government is going after the journalists because they apparently have failed in some way to discipline those within their own ranks not to leak to the press. So I don't understand why it is that the press has to be beaten up on and the First Amendment of the Constitution has to be compromised and violated because the government can't keep its own secrets. Isn't the onus on the government to keep its own secrets?
Well, yes, and in fact, you bring up a good point because, of course, the biggest leaker in the United States of America is the federal government. And the whole back and forth, the whole interaction between the government and the press is all about trading on secrecy and information. information is the coin of the realm. And, of course, the press is always trying to report that and I think has been doing so responsibly. If anything, they've been over-deferential to the White House and the government at large in terms of holding stories or not running them at all if there's objection to it. But going after the press, you know, really crosses the Rubicon in a way that we haven't seen since Richard Nixon's presidency.
Well, you have the paradox of the New York Times defending Fox News, if you will, in today's editorial, where they make it clear that the federal prosecutors asked a federal judge for permission to examine James Rosen, the chief Washington correspondent for Fox News, to examine his personal emails because of a probable cause to believe that Mr. Rosen is an aider and abettor and or co-conspirator in the leak. And apparently their State Department had him monitored and followed. And a part of the charge is that he employed flattery and was playing to Mr. Kim's vanity and ego, Mr. Kim being Stephen Jin-Woo Kim, a State Department security advisor who leaked a story which doesn't sound like it's particularly consequential about North Korea planning to launch a missile in response to being condemned for its nuclear test by the UN Security Council. The New York Times rightly points out the ridiculous nature of that charge of employing flattery, a person in the press flattering a government official. That's what they do, isn't it? I mean, that's the part of the job.
Absolutely. I mean, I know, whenever there's been a government assault on civil rights and civil liberties and First Amendment, it does create strange bedfellows. As happened with the secret surveillance and warrantless wiretapping, you have libertarian Republicans like Rand Paul teaming up with First Amendment icons, Democratic icons, who are all arguing that this is totally inappropriate to do dragnet surveillance on United States citizens. And I think here is another example where it doesn't matter what party you're with, if the government is surveilling journalists, whether you're the New York Times or Fox News, this affects everybody. It's not a partisan issue. And then in terms of the other thing you brought up, in terms of the flattery, I mean, trying to imply that Fox News somehow was an aider or an abettor or co-conspirator for soliciting information criminalizes the entire journalistic reporting practice. I mean, this is part of, the flattery and the asking follow-up questions or asking for documentary proof. This is part of normal journalistic practices. So to try to criminalize that is a complete infringement on the First Amendment, which is our bedrock of the Bill of Rights, which promises freedom of the press as being central to our democracy.
So there is this incredible double standard where 99% of the leaks come from the government through the front door, and those that go through the back door are the ones that now they're going after. So it's confusing for journalists if you can get, you get an important leak from a top official through the front door, and then a week later you find out something through the back door, and you end up being charged. I mean, I think that in many ways our democracy is better served by more disclosure. If you look at what happened to the build-up to the Iraq war and the extraordinary number of government lies that led us into that disastrous war, that still the consequences of which we still are living with and will live with for decades, the problem there is that there wasn't enough government leaks, surely.
Exactly. And I think you're hitting on the distinction between so-called authorized leaks, which is kind of an oxymoron, but that would be front door leaks made by people in the government who are always sourced as anonymous government officials who we can't identify because of an ongoing investigation or because of their position. and unauthorized leaks, or the backdoor leaks, in which information comes out that, you know, heaven forbid it should embarrass the government. But if you expose its illegalities, you're really going to get hammered. And that's a huge problem. I mean, it's total hypocrisy for the White House to be leaking the names of undercover operatives to Hollywood directors for the making of Zero Dark 30, and then trying to put my client in jail for revealing, or actually confirming, the name of an undercover operative to a journalist because this undercover operative was involved in the torture program. There's a difference there, and I think most people would be able to see there are good leaks and bad leaks. I mean, that's what defines whistleblowing versus leaking.
Sure. Well, in the case of the CIA officer who provided information to the filmmakers for Zero Dark 30, I think more, I don't know whether her name was ever released, but certainly it was her version of history that was released. And what wasn't released was the fact that this same CIA officer was the one who apparently prevented the FBI from finding out about the two Al-Qaeda operatives in San Diego who later flew the planes into the buildings. So that person was not without sin, and it would have been a more interesting movie if the whole if the full truth about who it was. So when you leak stuff too selectively, you get a very selective version of history. That's the problem with leaks, surely.
Well, I wouldn't even call it history at that point. I would call it propaganda. When you're only getting one side, and when the other side tries to come out, and you basically punish the other side by, you know, revoking their security clearance, by getting them fired, by putting them under criminal investigation, those are really heavy-handed, draconian tactics, more appropriate to a dictatorship than a democracy. So I think you really do a disservice to the country, and it becomes agitprop, you know, to have Zero Dark 30 kind of normalizing torture, while the people who did speak out against it, you know, none of the people who tortured, none of the people who wrote the memos justifying it, none of the people who destroyed the videotapes, and none of the people who actually carried it out, not a single one has been held accountable. But the guy who blew the whistle on it, John Kiriakou, is now in jail for 2.5 years away from his wife and 5 kids. Because he never tortured anybody. In fact, I think if John had actually tortured someone, I'm confident he would not be in jail today.
Well, Justin Raddick, what do you know about this AP case? Because my understanding is that the AP had the story from the leaker in the government, and then they told the White House, or the White House found out they had the secret, so they were asked to hold off for a while before they published it, which they did. And then they went ahead and published it, and now they're crying wolf. And I understand that it's very possible that that damage was done, because I believe that the British MI6 had recruited an Al-Qaeda double agent, which is apparently a very difficult thing to do, and that this person was exposed by this leak, and the Brits apparently are furious with the CIA, and I guess with the White House as well. So what do you know about the timeline there? Because that's obviously what's critical.
Well, my understanding of the timeline is that the AP was writing a story on this, and they let the White House know. The White House requested that they hold the story, which the AP did, which is valiant of them. They don't have to do that, but they did. Like I said, newspapers have been quite deferential to the government in that regard. And then the government gave them the green light about a week later, saying, there's no more danger, no one's in danger, but hold off until we make our announcement. You know, we want to get the big splash from that. But the AP was like, look, whatever. They made their own independent editorial decision to go ahead and publish. 24 hours later, the White House made an announcement, the government did, that in sum and substance said very much what the AP story did. But now the White House, Eric Holder, Justice Department in particular, is saying this is one of the biggest leaks he's ever seen in his career, definitely among the top two or three, and that it severely damaged national security, which is belied by the fact that the information was in the White House announcement, number one, the very next day, and number two, Brennan, who now heads the CIA, gave a pitch about it too, saying that no lives were in danger, there was no harm caused by this, and no one's life was ever at stake. And so now, the White House really has egg on its face because it's talking out of both sides of its mouth and has actually gotten caught, rather than, getting to bang the bully pulpit like they usually do with their usual fear-mongering. So I think the AP behaved correctly here. I think also under the guidelines that do exist, that the Justice Department does have for itself, that it is supposed to be a very, very rare occurrence upon which you would subpoena a journalist. That is an unholy thing to do. And therefore, they have their own guidelines, the government does, that says they will only subpoena a journalist as a last resort, and that subpoena must be limited in scope and duration and subject matter. And none of those things were true here. I mean, we know that this subpoena was for 2 months' worth of material and hooked into 20 different AP lines affecting up to 100 different journalists. So that is hardly tailored, carefully tailored to the specifics of whatever they were trying to prevent. And again, it's no big surprise that this came up as part of a leak investigation. Because again, as I keep saying, and I'm feeling like a broken record here, but these leak investigations are really a way of chilling free speech and keeping people silent.
Well, Jessalyn Radek, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
You're quite welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
Again, I've been speaking with Jessalyn Radek, who is a Government Accountability Project's National Security and Human Rights Director, where she works with national security and intelligence community whistleblowers, including those from the Defense Department, Homeland Security, NSA, and CIA. She recently represented former NSA official Thomas Drake in the government's unsuccessful prosecution of him under the Espionage Act and is now representing former CIA officer John Kiriakou. She served in the Justice Department as a legal ethics advisor for 3 years, which led her to becoming a whistleblower in the case of the American Taliban, John Walker Lind, the first high-profile terrorism prosecution following 9/11. The author of Traitor, The Whistleblower and the American Taliban, she has an article at the Daily Kos, Obama's Hollow Promise That DOJ Won't Prosecute Press. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with the editor of the Oklahoma Observer about the hypocrisy of the two senators who represent this staunchly Republican state.
I'm looking for a sign. I'm looking for the treason that I knew in 65. Beware, the South is yours. Oh, 1984. See, come see, remember me.
They got an all-night movie role. You said it would last, but I guess we enrolled.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Arnold Hamilton, the editor of the Oklahoma Observer, a 34-year veteran of daily newspapers. He's a former staff writer for the Dallas Morning News, the San Jose Mercury News, the Dallas Times-Herald, the Tulsa Tribune, and the Oklahoma Journal. His reporting on Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh's conviction was honored, along with the New York Times, by the American Society of Newspaper Editors. Welcome to Background Briefing, Arnold Hamilton.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And your two senators there, Tom Coburn and Jim Imhoff, are both Republicans, fiscal hawks. They've been against funding for disaster aids. They've opposed increasing funding for FEMA. They're looking like they've got egg on their face now. How are they explaining themselves?
Well, what sells in Oklahoma right now, unfortunately, is this notion that we have a monster of federal debt that is going to be borne by our grandchildren, and that we can't continue to spend like this. We're just going to spend ourselves into oblivion, and the United States, as we know it, is going to collapse. And of course, the reality is far different when you consider the percentage of debt versus our gross national product and things like that. We're really not in bad shape at all. It's really breathtakingly hypocritical when you consider the fact that Oklahoma is so dependent on federal dollars. Federal jobs are among the the federal government's among the largest employers in Oklahoma. Federal dollars that have come in for all kinds of projects. We are a recipient state in Oklahoma. We are not a donor state, and without all the federal dollars that came into Oklahoma, this state would be in serious trouble. But it's amazing how Inhofe and Coburn and the Republicans who have come to dominate the state of Oklahoma have managed to sell people here on the notion that the federal government is somehow the evil empire that we have to protect ourselves from, all the while we're receiving all these federal dollars back. But nobody wants to be seen as sort of accepting the federal dollars, it's put the Republican leaders in this state on a real tightrope in a lot of cases. And this is another example. Coburn at least is consistent in his position on this. He's demanded offsets for, you know, any federal spending for a long time, and he comes across, you know, looking fairly consistent by saying, you know what, even if it's my home state, I still hold to that principle that we have to have those offsets. Of course, if you're consistently wrong, where does that, you know, put you exactly? But Inhofe seems to be making it up as he goes along. You know, Hurricane Sandy was bad because there were all these goodies thrown in, but suddenly federal aid for Oklahoma is a wonderful thing that should be accepted because, by golly, we won't allow those little goodies to be thrown in. Well, that's the way the system has always worked and will continue to work. And he has happily played that game and gotten lots of federal pork for Oklahoma over the years. But when he gets it, it's wise, prudent spending. It's not the pork that it is if some other state receives it.
Well, on CBS's This Morning, Tom Coburn said the very kids that were rescued from the schools that were hit by the tornado, the very kids we're interested in, why should we saddle them when we're wasting money? In other words, he's invoking the children for his fiscal hawkish views, which, as you pointed out, don't have a lot to do with the overall reality of the economy. But obviously, he's a very deeply religious man, and my question would be about his religiosity, and the governor and all of these politicians, these Republicans who dominate your state, Arnold Hamilton. What about the kids that died? I mean, you've had a big tornado very near where this one happened a few years ago. The school was destroyed. It happened at 6 p.m., so that wasn't filled with kids. They reinforced the corridor so you have a safe room. There was no safe room for these schools. And the very teachers that the governor in Oklahoma vilifies and has cut their wages and tells them that they should arm themselves with guns at the same time taking away their funding, there's no safe rooms. It was the teachers who saved these kids. So I think Coburn's missing the point here.
Well, I don't think there's any doubt, but you know, irony seems to be lost on a lot of these folks, and not only in elective office, and they get by with it, of course, because their constituents are buying what they're selling at this point. But yeah, isn't it ironic that the teachers here, who have just been treated like serfs at best, particularly in the last 6 or 7 years since the Republicans took control of both houses of the legislature and then won all the statewide offices, they have been given scraps, basically, and nothing. There's been very little investment. It's remarkable to me. A lot of these folks seem to know the cost of everything and the value of nothing, and people are now beginning to wake up. Some rank and file voices, and they're particularly poignant when they come from parents whose children, you know, managed to survive this disaster. But folks are beginning to speak up and say, you know, it's a modest cost, but it's worth the investment to provide some safety for these kids at school, safe rooms, whatever it might be. And yet, you can't get the legislature in Oklahoma to fund new textbooks, much less a safe room at this point. Funding's been cut close to 30% over the last 5 years. And, you know, obviously the cost of doing business has not dropped 30% over the last 3 years. So are we investing in our future? Do we really care about our kids? Or are we just providing lip service and saying, yes, we're pro-education because we know that's what people want to hear? You got to put your money where your mouth is on this. And a lot of these folks haven't. And you have to wonder if we're reaching a critical point. This will be just another event in a long series of events that will eventually wake people up in Oklahoma to say, whoa, wait a minute, we're not investing the way that we should be in our future and certainly not in the safety of our children.
Again, Arnold Hamilton, the editor of the Oklahoma Observer, a 34-year veteran of daily newspapers. His reporting on Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh's conviction was honored along with the New York Times by the American Society of Newspaper Editors. So how did your state end up being controlled by these Christian fundamentalist politicians, both in the state houses, the governorship, the two senators? I guess in a way they represent the evolution of the Republican Party, where the corporatists and the Christian fundamentalists have sort of formed a political fusion that dominates the party. But what about the state? This is a state that has a history of left-wing labor radicalism some time ago, but nevertheless, I'm just trying to get a sense here of what the pushback is when you've got people like Tom Coburn, who are so certain of their beliefs, particularly when he talks about kids being saddled with debt is more important than protecting their very lives.
Well, it really, if you go back to the early 1960s, Senator Robert S. Kerr, who was regarded as the uncrowned king of the U.S. Senate, said that he believed that Oklahoma would one day become a solidly Republican state. And, of course, it was totally dominated by Democrats at the time, and people thought that he was crazy. But when asked to explain himself, he said there are two reasons why: the Daily Oklahoman, the state's largest newspaper, and the Southern Baptist Convention. And the influence of the Oklahoman over the years. Now, it's waned, as you know, with the changing media landscape in recent years. But it really helped set in motion a lot of this a corporatism and fundamentalism that we see in Oklahoma today. And when the Republican Party wedded itself with the Southern Baptist Convention and other sort of like-minded fundamentalist religious groups, it really turned the whole notion of separation of church and state on its ear. It is not at all unusual to hear politics preached from the pulpit these days in Oklahoma, and a lot of the congregants, of course, they believe their minister is God's man in the pulpit, and though I don't know very many of them who are MDs and thus necessarily equipped to talk about healthcare, or political scientists and thus equipped to talk about some of the political issues of the day. But that doesn't mean that they don't pound that from the pulpit Sunday after Sunday. And of course, what we see then in Oklahoma is, let's take the teachers, for example, because we were talking about them earlier and how they were the heroes, really, of this disaster and how mistreated they've been under the Republican domination of the last 6 or 7 years. Fully 40%, according to the polls, of the teachers in Oklahoma are voting Republican these days. So, in effect, they have somehow been convinced to vote against their self-interest. And the way that's taken place is, and if you talk to them about that, you know, they have been convinced from the pulpit that you can't be a Christian and vote for a Democrat, because Democrats are pro-abortion, they're pro-gay rights, they're pro all these things that undermine the traditional American family and traditional American society as we conceive of it, going back to, you know, the father knows best, leave it to Beaver days of the 1950s.
Sure.
And so, when you have a whole group of people who are willing to vote against their self-interest because they have been convinced their Christianity is somehow at stake, then you can see why a state like Oklahoma could turn so completely over the last 40 or 50 years. You know, this state has not voted for a Democrat for president since Lyndon Johnson in 1964. Mm. And in the last two elections, for the first time ever, a Democrat did not carry a single county in Oklahoma. None of the 77 counties gave Barack Obama a majority of their votes. And of course, you know, there are other reasons for that, not least of which is race in some parts of Oklahoma, unfortunately.
Well, Arnold Hamilton, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate this conversation.
You're welcome. Call anytime.
Again, I've been speaking with Arnold Hamilton, the editor of the Oklahoma Observer, a 34-year veteran of daily newspapers. He's a former staff writer for the Dallas Morning News, the San Jose Mercury News, the Dallas Times Herald, the Tulsa Tribune, and the Oklahoma Journal. His reporting on Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh's conviction was honored, along with the New York Times, by the American Society of Newspaper Editors. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back with a critique of capitalism. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Richard Wolff, Emeritus Professor of Economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and he's currently a visiting professor in the Graduate Program for International Affairs at the New School University in New York City. He's the author of Occupy the Economy, Challenging Capitalism, and his latest book is Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Wolff.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Ian.
And I mean, I suppose, in a way, capitalism is not so much an ideology as a fact. And the cure for capitalism, I guess, would be social democracy. Is that, am I on the right track?
Yes, but with this caveat that it depends a little bit on what you mean by social democracy. But the title of my book, A Cure for Capitalism, is intended explicitly to suggest that capitalism is now a very sick economic system, imposing a global crisis on the vast majority of people, It's been going on now for 5 or 6 years. There really is no end in sight. Government programs around what is called austerity are actually making the conditions for most people even worse. This is not a system that's working, and it needs either a basic transformation or we have to face the fact that the human race may be ready to move on to another economic system that will better meet its needs.
Well, it would seem to me that what's going on globally and particularly nationally with the widening gap between the rich and the poor is that we have unbridled greed and lack of social responsibility or a lack of a conscience about one's fellow Americans. So do you scrap the system or do you try and regulate greed?
Well, I think that in a sense, we used to up until, I don't know, 10, 20, 30 years ago, be proud of and defend the United States' capitalism, at least since the 1930s, precisely on the grounds that it wasn't extremely unequal between rich and poor, that it generated and supported a vast middle class, and that was the reason why one ought to support and endorse capitalism. I think what happened is that this was a big case of wishful thinking, and that the underlying dynamic of capitalism, once the trauma of the Great Depression had been pushed back in history, that the underlying dynamic of capitalism, which is to produce ever greater inequality, reasserted itself. And now you couldn't anymore, as we can't anymore, justify capitalism as we used to on the grounds that it generates a vast middle class, because precisely what capitalism is doing is decimating and destroying that middle class. And so suddenly what you see is the real underlying polarization, rich and poor. But I think that calling the emergence of people who are rich at one pole of this system motivated by greed is not right. I think greed as a characteristic that is alive in all kinds of people is pretty much a constant. That is not in the same person, but you have greed across a society, as you have all kinds of other emotions and desires. And the question is, how does a system work to contain those desires that are destructive and to encourage those that are constructive? The critique of capitalism is precisely that it is now moving in a direction that encourages greed and then wants people to kind of naturalize the whole thing. Rather than understanding we could have a different economic system, shift the discussion so the problem isn't the system that's moving in a certain way, but some unalterable human characteristic like greed. I really think that greed hasn't suddenly surged in the world. It's always been there, but that at other times and in other systems, it was nicely held in check.
Well, to some extent, you would think that what would hold capitalism in check would be socialism, and that was the hope. But in effect, basically, the legacy of communism is that it's given socialism a bad name. So without socialism as a practicing example, except, say, with the social democracies in Northern Europe, aren't we at a loss? I mean, that's what I'm suggesting in terms of the legacy of the communists, that they basically destroyed socialism and they've left the playing field wide open now for capitalism.
Absolutely. I think that you're fundamentally right. I would phrase it slightly differently. I would say that the efforts to institutionalize socialism and communism as alternative systems didn't work out very well, and that as a result, the realities of the Soviet Union or China or Cuba or Vietnam produced, most importantly, the inability of those systems to survive. And so the rest of the world looks at the contest, if you will, between capitalism and socialism and concludes that the socialist alternative, at least in the forms it took in the 20th century, proved unable to endure at least more than 75 years in the case of the Soviet Union. I think, however, you need to take a step back and assess what that means historically. For example, if you look at the transition from the system that dominated Europe before capitalism, a system that we give the name to feudalism, it took capitalism quite a few tries, some of which lasted 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years, before the transition from feudalism to capitalism found a form that could survive. In other words, early efforts to institutionalize capitalism didn't last, just like early efforts to make the transition from capitalism to socialism didn't last. But if you had concluded that because early efforts, and let's remember the Russians and the Chinese, those are early efforts to go beyond capitalism, the first ones, to conclude that because they didn't succeed, the project as a whole can't succeed, if you had made that judgment back in the 15th and 16th centuries in Europe, you would have been as completely wrong as one can possibly be, because it turns out that transitions from one economic system to another are very big processes. They take a long time. They involve lots of experiments, some of which don't work. They require a lot of learning by doing. And it takes a while to figure out what is needed to make the transition really stick and become a self-reproducing system. Feudalism had to learn that when it came out of the slave systems of ancient Rome. Capitalism had to learn that when it came out of the system of feudalism. And my guess is that socialism and communism are in exactly that learning process now.
Again, I'm speaking with Richard Wolff, Emeritus Professor of Economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and currently a visiting professor in the Graduate Program for International Affairs at the New School University in New York City. He's the author of Occupy the Economy, Challenging Capitalism, and his latest book is Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism. But it seems to what we're having now, Richard Wolff, is the worst of both worlds in both systems. And in a curious way, they're sort of coming together to form two different forms of oligarchy. There's nothing more toxic than the post-communist Russia system and the evolving Chinese communist-slash-capitalism system, in as much as you're creating these oligarchs who are able to expropriate state assets and become capitalist billionaires. And most of the elite in China have hundreds of billions of dollars stashed offshore. And we know about the Russian oligarchical system, which is often referred to as KGB Incorporated, run by the capo di capo of all of the oligarchs, the godfather Vladimir Putin, who's reputed to be one of the richest people in the world. So you have these evolving oligarchical systems that come out of collapsing communism, and on the Western side, or on the capitalist side, you have market capitalism turning into oligarchical capitalism and a corporatocracy.
Yes, I think you know that in academic life, for many of the last 40 or 50 years, there have been a whole group of theorists who upheld what came to be called the convergence thesis, which was precisely your point, that there's something going on in both the leading capitalist systems and those leading systems that called themselves socialist or communist that ended up making transformations of one into the other very easy. I mean, you know, it didn't take a big revolution in China for the changes to happen there that have happened over the last 25 years. There was no big revolution in Russia that changed things. It literally, one system kind of exhausted itself, you might say, and gave way to another one with actual very little in the way of a revolutionary change, at least as we have examples in history. So yes, I think there is a convergence. The concentration in the West of wealth is becoming downright ridiculous. The small group of people that are accumulating vast wealth are perfectly aware that as a system becomes more and more unequal in its distribution of wealth and income, it is either going to teach the people at the top that they have to control the society as it becomes more and more envious, jealous, angry, bitter at what's happening, or else risk its own overthrow. So what, of course, these concentrated wealth groups do is realize that the first thing that has to be taken away is the basic political democracy. You cannot allow a society to continue to have a genuine one man, one woman, one vote system politically, because you're just then creating the situation where the mass of people, the majority, that are excluded from the wealth, that are becoming relatively poorer, turn to politics to undo politically what has happened to them economically, to literally use the power of the ballot to undo the inequalities produced by capitalism. And so the capitalists, seeing that coming and having to be really very backward not to see it, realize that the next step is to control politics. And here in the United States, we have literally seen in the last two or three elections, you know, one billionaire after another picking whatever candidates seem to be useful to them, funding them so that they suddenly become relevant because the money is there to purchase the advertising that gives them a reputation. But more and more, even lower-level political jobs are basically up for sale, and the money, which is concentrated in ever fewer hands, buys the political system. And so you have the joke in Washington that the United States has the best democracy money can buy, but it becomes a very telling kind of humor because it's the recognition by almost everybody that we have precisely that concentration, first of wealth and income, but then of political power and pretty soon of cultural access. We're seeing the destruction here in the United States of the public higher education system, which was basically created after World War II to give the mass of people access to college. It's being cut. It's being dismembered. It's being replaced by internet open coursework so that you don't have to go to school anymore. Meanwhile, the elite schools who were there before the explosion of higher public education, the Harvards and the Yales and the Princetons and the Swarthmores, they continue to be what they always were, schools for the elite that the mass of people can't get into, can't afford, can't buy the extra supports for their children to be able to make them eligible, all the rest of it. You know, hundreds of signs across the country of this kind of descent into the kind of capitalism that is riven by these sorts of terribly socially divisive and, in the end, explosive inequalities.
Well, Richard Wolff, there's no question that our politics have been purchased. And if you make the political system about money and not candidates and ideas and ideology, you end up with what we have here. And the Supreme Court have recently ratified this completely mercenary politics that we have. Most of our legislators spend most of their time talking to rich people because they're the people who keep them in office. And when they do raise all their money from special interests, most of that money is then turned over to the media oligopolies in order to advertise or to hold at bay any challenger. And that is how the game is played. So in many ways, the way that our politics have been translated is that we have a system entirely controlled by the oligarchs who basically, you know, they own the Republicans outright and they rent the Democrats. And with a few exceptions, I guess, of Democrats in safe seats in minority areas, etc., most of them are entirely for sale. And the press, the corporate press, are the enablers of this system, and they beguile us with this kind of game show democracy that we have, where we have these elections and we have who's up and who's down, and they celebrate the process without anybody stepping back like you do and asking the important questions.
Yes, and I think, you know, there's an implication here that Americans, you know, find troubling, but I think there's no way out of it, which is coming up with another law, coming up with another regulation, coming up with something that will limit campaign spending or that will guarantee access to this one or that one to the media. This isn't going to work. We have been doing that for the last 50 years or longer, and it doesn't work because you can't survive with whatever inventive or creative regulation. What you can't do is prevent the increasing concentration of wealth from hiring the people who have the talent and who, by the way, are often the ones who developed the very laws and regulations in the government, and then get hired by these private interests, and then they work a way around it. And then they work a way around it, and then it takes the government 10, 20, 30 years to catch up and to pass another law and regulation. Meanwhile, the advisors to the wealthy, seeing it all coming, reading about it in the newspapers, have been busy getting ready for the next wrinkle, for the next new clause in the law, for the next new, shall we call it, loophole. This is an endless game, and at a certain point, the mass of people, unless they're foolish, and I don't think the American people are foolish, unless they're foolish, they got to realize we can't go that way anymore. We can't have another law, another regulation, because this has become an absurd procedure that we, in the end, always lose. And that's why, for me, the crucial thing is to change the organization of production. Stop putting wealth and incentives in the hands of a tiny group of people who will then use the wealth to pursue the incentive of keeping that kind of wealth, giving us the system and the dysfunction of the system that we have. And if you don't go to the root and change the basic institution, you're going to have the regulations, the reforms, the laws that are not going to work better in the future than they have proven themselves capable of working in the past.
But it seems to me, Richard Wolff, that the system that we have, which is largely driven by Wall Street and by the financialization of the economy, which has passed the 50% mark, that is its own internal death knell of capitalism, because the more and more you have a capitalism based on extracting wealth for the Wall Street oligarchs who do nothing, the richest people in this country are hedge fund managers. They absolutely contribute nothing, zero. So you have a system where the traditional rubber baron capitalists at least produced something. These guys don't produce anything. It seems to me that that's what's ultimately going to crash and burn.
Yeah, it might go that way. It might be the way that people make sense of what is happening and then take action based on that kind of an understanding. For me, I've always been amazed, whether it's a company that makes stoves or a company that makes software or a bank, that there's something that ought to have troubled the American people from day one. I mean, here is a country that needs to say 25 times a day how committed it is as a nation, as a history, as a people to democracy, to the idea that if you are affected by a decision in your community, then you must be given a participatory role equal to that of everybody else in reaching that decision. You cannot be expected to live with the effects of a decision from which you are excluded in terms of making the decision. Well, then here's what befuddles me. The place where Americans spend most of their adult lives is at work. In the office, in the store, in the factory, wherever. They're at work 5 out of 7 days from pretty much the time they get up and get ready to go to work. Then the 8 or more hours they're at work. Then the couple of hours they're kind of recuperating from work before they go to sleep and get ready for the next day. That's where people are. If you were committed to democracy the way you say as an American, then the first place it ought to be institutionalized is where you work, because that's a central part of your life. It's where you spend an enormous portion of your life. So either you're committed to democracy, and then it would be in the workplace, or you're not. But yet the truth of it is, 95% of us go to work in an office, a store, or a factory, where we are part of the workers. We do not participate in making the basic decisions. We have to live with them, but we do not participate. We do not have a role in deciding what this enterprise will produce. We do not have a role in deciding what technology will be used or where the production will happen. And most important, we do not participate in deciding what to do with the profits our brains and muscles help to produce. That's undemocratic. you know, a tiny group of people at the top, the board of directors, the major shareholders, decide, for example, to close the office and move to another state or another country. Or they decide to use a technology that boosts profits but fouls the water or the air. Or they decide to shut down one kind of production that the people in the office think is useful and socially desirable to produce something else which is socially destructive but more profitable. The workers have to live with the lost job, with the polluted air, whatever. But they do not have the right in a capitalist system to participate in making those decisions. Okay. Either you are a democratic society, in which case you have to have a democratic workplace, or you exclude democracy from your workplace, as we do, and that undermines your claim to be a democratic society. This should have, and I believe as capitalism becomes more and more of a burden on the mass of the American people, this contradiction, right at the core of the United States, is going to come to the forefront and be a very powerful way for Americans to come to terms with, to understand, and eventually to change the situation.
Well, just in closing, Richard Wolff, is there anything out of our history? I mean, first of all, in the very Declaration of Independence, after the part that they read in school, that we hold these truths to be self-evident, the next phrase that's never repeated is, if a government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to overturn it and replace it. We've seen some revolutions, some of them accidental, with McKinley getting shot and Theodore Roosevelt, the reformer, busting the trusts. We had some great people in those days in the press, like Mark Twain and Ida Tarbell, that helped enormously. We obviously don't have those kind of characters today in the popular culture. FDR, of course, saved capitalism, even though he's vilified by capitalists. I don't know whether it has to crash and burn in order for it to be saved, but what's your sense of, just in closing, of our lessons from history and what could happen to bring about the changes that you're talking about?
Well, in my experience, the change is already underway. Just to make it very personal in the couple of minutes I have, over the last 2 to 3 years, having been a critic of capitalism much of my adult life as a professor of economics, I can tell you, as I travel around the United States and in the north, the south, the east, the west, in union halls, in churches, in university classrooms, even in public auditoriums, the interest in and the enthusiasm for a debate about capitalism and the pros and cons of going beyond it are more interesting to the American people than I have ever seen in 50 years of doing this kind of work. So something is going on already in the United States. It doesn't get the kind of attention that the Tea Party does and all of that at the other end of the political spectrum. But I can tell you, and this is not secondhand, this is my own direct experience, I have never seen audiences this receptive. I have never gotten this kind of reception. I have never gotten this kind of enthusiastic questions. People are aware that the economic system, capitalism, which they always believed, whatever its problems, it was delivering the goods, is now seen to be delivering the bads. To them, to their over-indebted children discovering that a college education doesn't get you a good job, to all the things that are happening. And so they're turning and questioning. And my guess is we will see in the next few months and years all kinds of Occupy movements and wonderful individuals able to articulate this growing perception and finding ways to make the changes that that implies.
Well, Richard Wolff, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you again, Ian, and my best regards to you as well.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Nick Guarino. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.